Thank you all. We'll be seated. Good morning once again. Welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court sitting here at the University of Idaho Falls Law. Today, April 10, 2024, this is our second hearing of the day. We are taking up appeals in two separate cases. They are case numbers 50471 and 50472. That's only in reference to the parties up ahead of the bar here because in one of the cases, the city of Oslo is in the file, and in the other case, Brenda and Ray Juan Brusca and Robert Davis are appellants. So our purpose is the appellant today is the city of Moscow, Sarah Banks, and William Lambert. This case is entitled Juan Brusca versus City of Moscow, and so that's why the city is the appellant, represented by Andrew Tuskoff, and the respondents are Brenda and Ray Juan Brusca, and Robert Davis, represented by William Jeremy Carr. Counsel, do you have any preliminary matters for us today before your argument?
Your Honor.
Very well. Mr. Fisco, let me just see, sir.
Okay. May it please the Court. Andrew Russell, I'm here on behalf of the City of Moscow. And we are here today in merits of a water billing regulation that the City of Moscow enacted in 2021. I expect that everybody on the bench has read our briefs and surveillance facts, so I will not dwell on too great detail, but just to orient ourselves. The City of Moscow, at all time relevant to this litigation, has operated a public water system and has regulations that govern these water and standards. Prior to 2021, anybody who wanted a water control on a water account could call the city government office, open an account, and hook up a certain bill to receive water. This, of course, includes tenants and rental properties, and I don't think that I need to not surprise for anybody in the room that the city of Moscow is called Shannon. There are a lot of rental properties, and a call population is come to us. You'll have rental properties that have different tenants at any time. Over the course of years, there will be a lot of changeover. And what we have results rental properties, they were a great part inside of the city of Moscow. Collecting water bills from these rental properties was different. The city had, and still does have, an ordinance that says all water charges shall be the ultimate responsibility of the property owner. It's Moscow City Code, Title 5, Chapter 4, Section 4.4. But actually enforcing this was very difficult, and it's very difficult because this court in 1989 decided a case entitled City Bridgeville versus Haskin, 116-905-35, and I will tell in the specifics of the city of Granville v. Haskin in a moment, but broadly speaking, the city of Granville v. Haskin said in one way, shape, or form, it is not ordinarily the case that you can, as a city, go ahead and collect water bills that are incurred by tenants from a body. There might be scenarios where it's allowed, asking to not foreclose the possibility that this might be a perfect by contract, but it could not require an authority that could be applied from the provisions of Idaho statute or reference by the parties in Haskin. So, this brings us to 2021. As I mentioned, rental properties were a recurrent problem for the city of Moscow. And the city of Moscow attempted to address this by enacting Resolution 2021-01, which was a ordinance that sought a regular rental bill process. Now, under the changes enacted, all property owners in the city of Moscow must submit a billing application. The billing application requires that they contact the property owner, explain it's a formal request for water service to the property and at their specific address, and it requires the property owner to acknowledge and agree that they will remain legally responsible and liable for them motion to have it hand still directly, that requires 7 form. But that also ultimately states that if there's also the property owner, if there's one day the property owner can be asked to pay them. And if the property owner refuses, the city can initiate certain collection activities. So this change was enacted in February 2021, and the city gave property owners probably a year to complete a form for all their properties. So written notes was sent out on double occasions, and going forward, as time went on, in July, the city sent out written notices to all account holders that had not completed a building application. And they did so again in November. And by the time November rolled around, I don't know the exact figures, but there were very few holdouts. There were only a handful of properties that had not completed, property owners that had not completed building applications. In November, the holdouts received notice. One of those holdouts was the plaintiffs, Griffiths and Mr. Davis. They, luckily, all more common several problems within the city. And they, along with other holdout property owners, in November that basically entered this. They submitted a building application by September 15th. We will consider shutting out your water. The Longman Griffiths and Mr. Davis opposed this. They informed the city they did not intend to do so. The city told them again what policy requires, and they eventually returned building applications under protest, claiming that they effectively been forced to do so without any choice of that. They then filed suit, and in a case that initially sought preliminary injunctive relief, but eventually eventually they entered a complaint and sought declaratory relief and fell on a cause of action. This case was eventually decided on a motion for motions for summary judgment. And in the ruling that the district court issued below, the district court found that the billing applications with regards to the tenant rental properties that the plaintiffs owned, they had, in fact, entered those contracts under arrest, and thus the contracts, the building applications were null and void, they could not be enforced. The district court, however, also found that as far as the utility applications they completed for the properties they owned, that overmind. They did not think that the duress finding on the black of it. If reasoning is kind of sparse on why that is, but for reasons that I got out of my brief and will get into now, I think that it falls directly from this court's case law. And for the point, I think that the district court's ruling as far as rental properties are concerned, and that's a sort of more difficult issue because I do not dispute that City Green will be asking the city to really, I feel like every time I read that decision, I understand it less. It is a difficult decision to wrap my head around. And I urge the court to at least clarify it, but I won't get the specifics of what that might look like in a moment. That being said, as far as the litigation at this point is concerned, I also raised other objections as far as standing is concerned. I would be completely thrown off. I would walk away thrilled if you dismissed this case on standing grounds, but I would be somewhat disappointed because I would really like to know what exactly City Grant Phillips asked me. For reasons that I said, it is a decision that I have, it perplexes me. So anyways, very briefly on standing. It's difficult to wrap my head around how this case satisfies the case of controversy requirement. That is to say, we are not debating a dilemma problem. It was undisputed below that the plaintiffs were up to date, their pens were up to date, and they not disavail at any time of this litigation. So what we are deciding here is what might happen if the city at some point decides, oh, there's a month ago, now we can initiate collections activities, now we can force the billing application against you. To the extent that we are asking, or plaintiffs are asking for, to assume facts and to delve into a letter there to establish an actual dispute here about the application we suggest us in.
Help me understand that argument for a second, because whether we're calling this coercion or whatever we call it, the bottom line is the respondents, I guess, for calling it for sake of this case, were forced to do something against their will. There's no other place to get water, I'm assuming. There's no private vendor. There's no ability to drill. So they were forced to do something they didn't want to do, which they claim harmed them. Is that not enough?
But that, Your Honor, I'm not sure if that is harmless. They have had to sign a billing application. They haven't had a bill collected against them. They haven't had a bill enforced against them. That they want to pay
they were forced to do something that put their financial situation in more jeopardy than it was before.
I mean, they
set themselves at risk.
Okay, that's what you're saying. I still think that they're at least removed from that actual tangible harm here. I mean, you're talking about increased risk of financial injury. We're not talking about actual tangible harm here. So, I don't want to dwell on standing. This is an issue that was raised the first time on appeal, which under your corporate source cases we can do. But we're here to review the issue, and if you want to assume for the sake of argument that you have standing, I know that this court's cases also indicate that the Iowa Constitution does not have a case of controversy requirements. You could simply assume for the sake of argument that you have standing. And this is an actual live case of controversy. Article 3 is not valid, so we don't have an unflagging duty to determine and reassure yourself that you actually have paid controversy for you. You can, under your dark basis, assume that you have standing and move on to the merits of the issue if you're a sophomore.
Why do we have to do that? I mean, this is, as I look at complaints, your complaints, it's a declaratory judgment act case. The whole purpose of the Declaratory Judgment Act is to allow people to bring disputes to the court to be decided, even when it can't satisfy traditional standing requirements. Like you can bring a breach of contract, you can bring a declaratory judgment action and a breach of contract or a contract case, but where a breach ever occurs. So, it seems to me that the standing analysis doesn't work when we have a declaratory judgment act to be suggested.
I do not entirely disagree, but the cases that I cited in my brief, this court has applied the standing analysis to better judgment action form. This is that I filed a site of power, it was the only one of the cases we cited in my brief for this proposition, and all I can say is what I've said so far. We are not talking about a tangible injury. We're talking about a contract that might apply away. If certain facts develop that would harm them. I think that this court is just, I don't think we're at a point where we had a tangible by Congress. If there was a dispute bill, I would not dispute that there was a tangible, actual harm and injury for this court to decide and make a decision on. So, does that answer your question? We also mentioned the catfish standing rule. This was a doctor that was identified in the U.S. State of recent decision to report that I was also involved with, the Radford versus City of Lewiston case. I think it's kind of strange that we have any agreements that every doctor in City of Lewiston, sorry, City of Moscow, is dealing with that we have an injury that is specific to a party that suffered the same injury. Everybody had to go on the same billing application. But again, as I said, the smaller question, I think that if the board is inclined to be standing here, it has the authority of those cases to do so. So with that said, I'm adding a lot of merits. Unless you have any further questions that you want to address as far as standing. being active individual for you to see how Russell in Moscow doesn't have to do here is not exactly just this line. Laid out and said, that is probably not.
Baseline didn't approve or suggest that a city could unilaterally change a contract with it.
I don't think it did, but to the extent that we are talking about this sort of weird case in that we are talking about both contract, both government, where they require contracts. And this court's case has gone back a long way and say that cities can enact regulations governing provision of utility services. And you can require certain types of applications, you can require payments. And thus, I don't think we looked at this line and said, you can be unilaterally, you know, here's a contract, that's the end of it. But that's not what happened here. This was the city enacting through this lawful authority, a loan requirement requiring a building application to submit. And then they said, plaintiffs raised some arguments at various points below in their briefs to suggest that they should have been allowed to keep their own agreements. That just seems bizarre. I understand why they don't want to comply with the regulations the city of Moscow enacted, but the city of Moscow, on their previous career, the city of Moscow said we no longer agree with the prior informal arrangement whereby you can just call up and have an informal under agreement for the central bill on a monthly basis. So they said, this is how you get water service, no water service. And to the extent that this is improper, Haskin did not actually disturb the line of cases from this court that said, this is something that I hold up for this. Haskin specifically referenced Adverse Consumers Code of Living, a 1909 case, 117 Iowa 204, 104 FERC Pacific Reporter, and it specifically also referenced Site of Approval Schmidt versus City of Kimberly, 74 Iowa 48, 256 Site of Approval Reporter, 8515. Schmidt specifically says that cities can shut off water, doesn't matter if it's a necessary service or not, if they have authority to govern the conditions on which utility services are provided.
Right, the rules are different than what we got here, which was the city saying, if you want water, and we're the only game in town, if you want water, you have to sign this agreement, you need to accept all of our terms. And so I think a predicate question is, does the city have authority to do that at all? When somebody has been paying their bills, and I understand what you're saying, essentially, month to month, you know, contract by agreement, and the city gave notice, the gives notice that we don't want these terms anymore, this is what we do. For me, the question is the next issue, which is what limitations are there on the terms and conditions that the city can impose in that agreement where the city holds the key to the only source of water. So what's the standard we apply when we look at the terms and conditions the city included in its application slash order?
I think that the answer to that question is found in another one of your own court discourse cases, Calder versus Boys of Water Co., that's the 90 case. And that case says that essentially, you have the regulation must be reasonable. I mean, again, I'm paraphrasing, it's not the exact wording that it's set out there, but at the bottom line, there is a limit, and the limit is, in some sense, what is a reasonable regulation. And I would submit that what we're talking about here, the city is not requiring that the property owners sign over the entire bank. All it would require is a agreement that acknowledges that they cannot be responsible for water bills that are unpaid, that their tenants, from whom they are presumably collecting rent and property from, are those bills should be able to be collected somehow.
And I understand that, but then explain to me why the lien provision is reasonable.
I mean, I'm just not entirely sure means or a provision or a way to collect on a bill.
It's tied up with property. Yeah. And that's the concern, right? Is
yes,
I'm renting this property. Yes, you know, I recognize there's always the potential that my tenants may skip out and not pay water, and I have to provide water to provide property that I can rent. I get all of that. But why is forcing the property owner to agree to the imposition of a lien against his real property reasonable when there are other remedies that you could avail yourself of, even if you had the responsible for your tenants? Bills, you can still pursue them in small claims court or a magistrate court, assuming they don't get astronomical, and pursue it that way and reduce it to a judgment. Why the power of lien? Why is that reasonable?
It's a part of them. Hell, as I said, liens are one of many methods of collecting on a debt.
But typically, liens are only prescribed by statute. So, Holly, what is the city's authority to create a lien through contract? And particularly, I don't think there's any dispute, this is a contract of adhesion for a life's necessity.
To the extent that we are, should also emphasize that I believe billing applications are required to be created simply one of many options that the city might pursue. So, to the extent that a lien may or may not exist or may arise, this is one of many tools in the chest. And to the extent that I'm having a difficult time understanding why selecting from one method of collection versus another is inherently unreasonable. I think that to the extent that the property owner has owned the property, collected rents, they probably have thought of the rent that is collected. Why the city should have to take one tool out of the tool chest to try to put payment on that bill.
Because ordinarily, you require somebody who claims their own money to show up in court to file a suit to prove the evidentiary basis why they're owed the money. A lien is different because a lien doesn't involve any finding of anything. A lien is, I'm going to sign a piece of paper with the city of Moscow, go ahead and count your quarter, and now I can tie up your real property.
And that's on behalf of someone who didn't consume the water. Right? I mean, we're talking about here collecting from the person who is not the consumer.
I mean, it's a part of the tenant's problem,
right.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. I mean, I understand your question, and I would submit to the court, but it's just difficult for me to understand why we are also wrong on differentiating between what all plans I did, and whether it's setting bill collections, whether it's initiating small claims, process, lawsuit, it'll be displayed within your property or maybe it's you.
Really, we're talking about the difference between a pre-judgment lien and a post-judgment lien, one of which involves due process and the other doesn't.
Right.
And so the tool in the city's toolbox, which is it? Pre-judgment and post-judgment?
I mean, to the extent that any debt actually didn't provide, I'm not sure. To the extent that it's written into the billing application, it's not specified. It's simply said that the lien might be pursued and placed against the property.
Right, but I mean, if it's post-judgment, every judgment can turn into a lien, right? So, obviously, the only way this would be worse than that would be if it was applied to pre-judgment. Can this be applied to pre-judgment?
I'm aware of anything that says it can or can't be.
So it could be.
Potentially, I think, yes.
So that's the distinction. Pre-judgment versus post-judgment.
Yeah.
If it was post-judgment, why would you need to put it in the application?
Yes.
Again, we need to create that operation law. So why would if the city wasn't intending a pre-judgment lien, why wouldn't the city just say we can pursue all avenues of collection to collect on the tenants outstanding bills for you, property owner?
I mean, it's my understanding of what the term essentially says, although of course it does include the language, it does include that term, but It does not. Just does not seem as though this is some inherently involved process. It's a collection activity. It is one amongst many. It is not necessarily one the city is going to go first solve, but they're probably all going to have to call the involved member and say, look, you know, maybe they're not. Do we need to initiate a small claim lawsuit? Do we need to investigate that or pursue other options? I mean, to the extent that, including language and permissible is inherently unreasonable, I guess I would have to concede that, this provision had a problem. But I don't think that it does. I don't think that, this court needs to draw so firm and bright a line underneath, a provision that simply says, well, these are one of the things we do, this is one of them.
Which I chose to have the issue then. Does Idaho law allow under these circumstances a prejudgment plea? I mean, certainly, the advantages of a prejudgment plea, I can understand what you want to do. I mean, it creates a cloud, it creates more pressure on the debtor to pay you, and then if they don't, then you pursue foreclosure, right? But if it's a post-judgment plea, you just go straight to court.
Right. I think that asking to the extent that they address the question of whether means are permissible under Idaho statute is said not on the provision side. I'm not aware of the other provisions that would necessarily apply. So that brings me to one of the issues that I stand before you asking. Why wouldn't asking be reconsidered, and to the extent that the provision that our bond act and the other government code provision that was cited in there, it could just not. I think that you can infer this power from them pretty easily. It is unusual and strange to me that you have the authority to present a bill and provide services, but not really able to collect it. And so
I don't disagree with Justice Hunley either, but I don't think he was talking about this specific remedy of a pre-judgment lien. I'm just not aware of any instances whereby adhesion, there's a statute that allows you and Idaho to create a pre-judgment lien. And certainly one can contract for such a lien, that suggests that there's some negotiation going on, but to require a pre-judgment lien to be issued in an adhesion contract scenario, I'm just not aware of where that has happened in Idaho unless it's specifically allowed.
Yeah.
For example, a labor material.
As I stand here in front of you today, I'm not aware of any case that specifically held that come out in circumstances particularly closely analogous to this. But I just need to come back to the fact that the city has authority to bother and then not within Logan utility services, and if they can't put on the bill, some of these maintenance and some of these maintenance are right there down. And so I would want to be said at least to honest authority to be implicit in these statutes and allow the provision of utility services within this county as per year. And at a minute left, but it was certainly not involved. So
very much so, thank you.
Please support James Jerry Meyer, representing Methodist Brother Brandon Ball, recently in Mr. Davidson's case. I will try to reach a little bit fast too much. I know the court has read my briefs and this case really does involve, I think, the resolution that the city of Moscow implemented on February 16, 2021, resolution 4.1.1, which provides a new billing system that the city of Moscow implemented for their water services. I think one of the board has to keep in mind is that the city of Moscow is the only water source that not been the city limits have to obtain water. There's no ability for them to drill a well or have any other water source. So I obviously the city of Moscow is the only water source in town. The city of Moscow required the plaintiffs in this case to sign new contracts, which were kind of twofold, if you will. One contract was for property owners, and the other contract was for property owners to sign for the tenants. And those contracts had two different options for the property owners and the tenants to use. One of which would will the landlord directly for the water that their tenant used. And then the second was to have the tenants be built those
Yes, good question. If the city of Moscow had waited to implement this change with the clients until their current tenants vacated the property and the water service was ready to be put in somebody else's name, either a new tenant or for the property owners, would your client have any objection to the change that the city of Moscow has made?
It is really based on, I think, on the Haskins decision, the city of Northwest Haskins decision. And the city used, I think, Justice Heisman's concurrent decision to, because this court of the Haskins determined that, the property owner by statute was not liable for their tenants' water services, and that the city had no legal rights by statute to lien the property owner's property and make the property owner liable for the water that their tenant had used. I think that is the holding that this court had in the Haskins decision.
Well, let me ask you about that. Is there only the Haskins? We have five person court. We have two who wrote about it in, or one wrote it in 3. We have one who agrees in the result, but for different reasons, and then we have one who dissents. So without three people explicitly joining the reasoning of the lead opinion, do we have a holding in Haskins?
I think there was a holding that the judges, three of the judges agree on, at least that the statute didn't allow them to be filed on the homeowner's property. Beyond that, I think that's the
point. Whether that or whether the absent contract, the statute didn't give the city of Grangeville implied authority to impose obligations on landlords or property owners for unpaid bills of their tenants. Is the whole thing that happens really about the city of Grangeville implied authority?
Yes, I understand your question, right? I think the answer is yes. I think the holding is that liens are preached to statute. And there is no statute that allows the city to lien a property owner's property in the absence of a contract that is lost in that memory.
So in this case, I'm trying to figure out where the lien comes from, because I've looked at the resolution, and I've looked at the attachment A, which is the Moscow utility billing policy, and it doesn't really discuss liens, does it? The liens show up in the sign-up forms, which we're not calling a resolution, I don't believe, and the sign-up forms talk about, they don't even talk about whether it's a pre- or post-judgment lien. They just say liens may be placed on property for non-payment. So that could be referring to a post-judgment lien. So really, how do we know what kind of lien authority exists beyond what's in the resolution and the attachment?
Well, I think the my reading of the bill of directors of power that was that it was giving the city the right footing
resolution that I'm looking at the first attachment, it says that in section 3.4 that if requested, assessments of balances, including candidate owner, will be provided to the title company at the time of a property sale or foreclosure. That doesn't sound like a pretty good ruling. That sounds because there wouldn't need to be a request if it had already recorded with the lien. It's not like, yeah, if we find out the property is being sold, we're going to show how much you owed on this property. So that doesn't sound like a pretty good lien.
That's
outside
of your detail.
Yeah, I'm looking at section 3, paragraph 4. Attachment A. If requested, assessments of balances will be provided to the title company. The only reason to provide it is there if it's a lien that's been filed. I don't think it'll know that for any of this.
Right, so the lien, I mean, section gives the right to put a lien out there, or talk after we've given them the right to put a lien on the property. How else would it be like this?
Well, I mean, I'm looking at the contract, and the contract's ambiguous. The contract says liens may be placed on a property for non-payment. It doesn't say when. Free judgment or first judgment. So when we go back to the ordinance is a lien.
No, the ordinance did not. I agree with that. The hot issue was more with the contract, which has that the placing of the with about the secure all that's due, which says approving the knowledge of just discontinuing third services and placing it on the property.
So just to be clear, I just want to make sure I'm not missing something that I often do. Where is there any authority for a lien in the ordinance? Is that a true really objective?
No, I don't think there's the ordinance item which says the mission of a lien. The ordinance requires the property owners to sign a contract, and the contract is what gives the city the lien, right? And the significance of that is the city is asking a property owner to give them something that they don't by statute have. They don't have the statutory right to give a lien and put it on property.
There's nothing in statute that would prevent them from getting a judgment, you know?
No.
What about section number three, section 4518, which allows a lien to be created by contract, and that would not apply here to allow the city to create a lien via contract?
In theory, yes, and I think that's where the city was going with it in reading passages, but then that's why I think where we address the adhesion contract, where it really was a unilateral contract where the city say, here, give us a right that we don't have, or we're going to shut off the water, not give you the water. Not with any other ability to obtain water for property.
Right, and then to be clear, the fact that the contract is a contract of adhesion standing alone does not validate the contract. The question is whether this adhesion contract, assuming it's specific about to be enforced, is not unconscionable or otherwise in violation of public policy. Right, but we're not just arguing because it was an adhesion contract, it's not enforceable.
No, our argument is the city is basically saying that if you want water, you have to enter into a contract with us, and that contract allows us to get a lien right that we would not otherwise have. And I think that's my question. I think you have a situation where the city is controlling a source that the landlords have to supply tanks and have to residents so they can get rid of. And they're saying, if you want this, you have to agree to the terms that you want and give us all the price.
And so, as I read your briefing, I understand that you're not taking issue with the city asking for a contract or a signed agreement. You're taking issue with the terms in this contract. Do I understand that? Okay, so I'm asking the same question I asked Mr. Pluskall, which is, okay, city has the power to do this contract, does this contract, what standard do we apply when we're considering applying to clients? That these, some of these terms should be enforced. What's the standard we apply?
The standard for reviewing the contract.
Right. Is it just a straight unconscionability analysis, or are you arguing, Mr. Pluskall, arguing it's reasonableness? Is there a reasonableness standard we should apply to this contract or the terms you're challenging, or do you have to be the standard for anyone who's termed by the board of policy where unconscionable, I ask, because the bottom score is pretty high.
The standard would be a reasonable part of the terms of contract, reasonable or not. And I don't think it is reasonable to give the city that kind of power when we're not, it's mainly the lien statute, that's what we appeal on the homeowners into, but the argument on the lien statute is the same for both.
So is it the lien that's really your only problem with this?
It's not the only one, but it is certainly the main one, yes.
Because I don't understand what other problems were. Okay, what you stated is very similar to the position taken in the amicus brief, which is that this is a reasonable standard that we should apply. It's not like you agree with the amicus brief. But based on that, we argue there's nothing unreasonable about the burden being shifted to the landlords, who are the ones that receive the money, determine who the tenants are, who vet the tenants, know how trustworthy they are in advance. They can get security deposits. They're the ones making all the profit. And so the risk should be on them instead of on all the other taxpayers that are using the system. That's apparently the decision of the city council. Why is that an unreasonable consideration?
Well, I don't know if that's true. It's false and taxpayers for the landlords. Certainly the landlords collect rent, but as Justice Eisenhower indicated in this current decision, the city does have the ability to go to tenants and require them to put some sort of security deposit out to the bill or to somebody else that's a willing and I would say it's a willing grantor from here for some of the utility of the water. And if that person agrees, so I don't know if it would necessarily pass a fall to the landlord or the taxpayers. I think the city would have the ability to go to the tenants or acquire the user and say, we want some more security if we're going to provide them for a lot of these available.
So you can put the burden on the itinerant students to pay more fees?
Or their parents as a grantor.
It seems to me that these are tough policy questions and they're somewhat unique to communities like Moscow. Very similar to where I come from in Moscow, where you have a relatively small town of 20,000-30,000 people, and then you have 20,000 college students coming into town who make up almost half the population for a time. And then a lot of them leave. In fact, almost all of them leave one time or another. So the city has made a policy determination that that we don't want the taxpayers on the hook for this. We'd rather have the people that are in a position and are profiting from those students to have that risk. Why is that unreasonable?
Well, I think part of the concern from the landlord's perspective, or landlord's perspective, is if the city's allowed to do this, the landowner is on the hook for a bill, if you will, that they have no control over.
Well, the landlords have the ability to collect security deposits just as you're making the city want to. So why shouldn't it be on the property owners? Be part of their responsibility to make sure that they either got security from the medical tenants or that they even make decisions to rent to responsible tenants in the first instance.
Certainly, they would agree with the security, but they still require them to be responsible for the water bill that they do not use, that they are worth benefiting from.
They're only pushed out on the benefit from it because they can't rent any of this property without water. Right? And so they have to have water to the property in order to be able to charge whether it's a business or a student to live there. And so I struggle with the argument that they may not technically be using the water, but they're absolutely benefiting from it because without it, they can't rent these properties, can they?
No, yeah, there certainly is some secondary benefit from investment, for sure.
It makes the property rentable. I mean, if it's really a secondary benefit, that water, they're zilch.
Well, without dollars, you wouldn't be able to build the apartment complex without a water effect, would they? The city would not be able to approve that, would they?
Correct. No, I mean, yes, they can't, but they're still making the landlord responsible for a open-ended bill, if you will. They have no ability to control on that.
But the landlord is the account holder, right? And so presumably the account holder, he can call in and say, I want to print out what's everybody using, and then they can deal with it. I mean, they could write in water usage limitations into their lease. They could and say, you know, if you use about this much, then we're going to renegotiate, and then I'm giving you your deposit, and you're going to have to pay more rent. I mean, they have the right ways that they can monitor the water usage and charge accordingly, don't they? So why isn't that a reasonable allocation of the burden?
They don't need the city's ordinance or the contract that allows them to cancel the tenant's landlord relationship, or if they are, just because the tenant is high on rent, and if they have a year-long lease, they can't just because the tenant's behind on the water, will come in and renegotiate the term of that lease. They're still stuck under the terms of that lease agreement for until it expires. And at the end of that time, it goes over the water bill.
And my point is not that they would renegotiate or terminate the lease, but they have ways they can address the water consumption and the amount of water consumption in the lease.
In the initial lease.
Right.
Correct. I guess on a new lease, but if in this situation they have existing lease agreements, they were not elected.
So I think that the problem for past leases not moving forward.
Certainly, that is moving forward. They would be able to use it. They do that, but I guess then the question comes from to this court is who should have that burden, the landlord of the city? Because the city can do that on the front end, the same thing with the security for the tenant, whereas the landlord may not, they are married to it.
Isn't that what landlords typically do? I know every time I was involved in a situation where city rector wanted to increase their local property tax rates and things like that, the first thing we hear from the landlords is, oh, we're going to have to pass this on to the students. I mean, isn't that what typically happens to the landlords? And so if there's increased risk created by this policy, it will likely be the tenants that will in the end have to take that.
It is, I guess that gets on to another, some other policy issue of, is that good for tenants when we already have housing crisis in these universities that offer rent for students is high. Are we going to add to that if the burden of landlord that's resolved is you may have more of a housing crisis than you already do in some of these small towns?
You're right, of course, if they plus too much of a burden on landlords, then you don't want to build new facilities, right? And so obviously, I think the city had an interest in, you know, killing the, you know, boost the rate for a living for it. But by the same token, they also have to do something that has a little bit of makes sense from a business perspective. So there's a balance that goes on with the government and with the landlords, typically in situations.
There is, yeah, I wonder that. I just think in this sense, it's big oversight.
Okay, fair enough.
And so I just want to really quickly jump to your question regarding public policy, consumer protection arguments. I understand you're challenging the lien as unconscionable violation of public policy and violating the Consumer Protection Act, am I right?
Yes.
And are there any other effects of this agreement that you're challenging as violating those three?
I guess the lien is certainly made in to a lesser extent, I think, challenging the fact that the, what we've been discussing, that the landlord has the, or the city has the ability to make a viable landlord basically guarantor of the tenant's market.
Does anyone challenge that the timing of the implementation of these changes? And then I said back to the question I asked in the beginning, is the way in which the city of Moscow implemented this change, is that a issue for your clients? That not having a grandfather clause, not waiting until there was a change in account orders?
Certainly, it will give you kind of a general brief, the time issue is too far away. As the question pointed out, none of these tenants were in default with the water bills. And so you had clients that the tenants that were current under water bills, and now they're forced to enter into a blue agreement that is a pretty significant change. And yeah, that would have been less of an issue if they would have waited, and then when they had new users coming on and implemented a FIN, then I think certainly some of our cautionary clubs would be concerned about at that point. So I think I would need a lot of advice for that. I hope that I answered your question.
I mean, this is the major position in terms of writing an ending about where, you know, the end is at the beginning and the end of the point. I had a lot of understanding of the client's position on that issue, and your answer, where you're going to be real comfort. I still feel like, well, kind of every time is an issue, but kind of not an issue. And so,
I think a lot of this is appears that the fellows are asking the court to, in essence, reconsider the city of Grangeville Castles. And I do think probably some of this is a legislative issue for the court to determine if they're going to allow the statute is pretty clear. I think there's no statutory provision that allows the city to go after homeowners for a lien. And I do think that is the amicus brief pointed out some other jurisdictions. And the state of those other jurisdictions in Georgia and Minnesota have statutes that allow the city to apply lien rights to the property specifically. And I does not have that. So I think some of this is probably most appropriate for the legislature.
But now you're between the lien issue and the mix, and what I was thinking about timing, and I'm really thinking about the landlord as the guarantor, who I don't necessarily the lien issue, because I look at the lien issue as being pulled here, and then I look at the timing of the implementation and the landlord's
I think the grantor issue, I think it is unconscionable when you have the city forcing the homeowner to guarantee their tenants. Right, by side of the task of the city, use the word of willing grantor, yeah, I understand that was a thing, but I think that was a key distinction when you're looking at the city forcing the landowners to make a contract that basically is having them guarantee their tenants' parking. I guess to try to clarify my earlier question, I don't know the timing of when that occurs changes if there's a new tenant coming in and the city's still making the landlord guarantee that contract. I think so, probably less so than at least that notice of if that's going to happen, then it requires some security or some concern.
I'm understanding your argument to be it's unconscionable to require the landowner to sign any contract for a property the landowner doesn't occupy.
Yes, we're guaranteeing the tenants.
I'm talking about any contract because based on what you just argued, that it's unfair to require them to sign this. I mean, that logic extends to any agreement other than an agreement for a property they occupy.
All right.